Right. So management then. So we've made an examination. We think it's more about obstruction. What are we going to do next?
So I followed the Seacrest pattern for all these patients. So cursory history, ABCs, assess and correct. My next steps in management, having done my history and examination, would be make sure I've got some IV access, get my blood tests off, things that are important to help me make decisions down the line. Have they got a marked inflammatory response? Are the kidneys happy?
So what blood tests are you going to do? Just what are you going to type into the computer?
I do a full blood count because I'm interested in the white cell count. If that's sort of 16, 20 plus, then that's a marker that something is going on that we might need to do something about. I'm going to look at urea and electrolytes, particularly looking for evidence of an acute kidney injury. As I said, there's a 1 in 5 rate of that at admission, mm-hmm. and that is associated with higher rates of major complications at 30 days. And those are things that we can start to intervene on now. We can start fluids. If someone's got a big inflammatory response, we probably should start some antibiotics because they might be having bacterial translocation. So that, and that's actually, you know, we can argue about clotting if someone's going to have a laparotomy. You probably want to do a group and save at the same time. Think, assume these people are going to have an operation, and then you're not scrambling to do this 2-3 days down the line when things go wrong. That would be most of it. And then with my access, I'm going to start some fluids running. Doesn't really matter what. Probably going to start a bag of saline, given at a rate that's appropriate to their hemodynamic status. Mm-hmm. We'll get the catheter in if there's not one already in. And actually, if I'm convinced that this is small bowel obstruction, I'm going to be putting the nasogastric tube in at the same time, because this is when we talk about drip and suck, this is the basic management of small bowel obstruction. Nasogastric tube for gastric decompression allows you to aspirate things off the stomach before they get aspirated onto the lungs, which potentially, you know, could bring your patient to harm. It also helps you move on to the next steps a bit further. Obviously, the catheter, as I said, kidney injuries are important, and IVI is important to help with that third space losses. And obviously, you're going to make the patient nil by mouth. It's nothing more annoying than putting an NG tube in. Patient sits there necking back water, and there's 3 liters out of output in the bag, and no one knows whether that's actually bile or something else. Mm. So those would be my initial steps, and then I would be moving on to my special test to confirm my diagnosis after this. Uh-huh. And this is my first sort of bugbear here. Classically, the teaching is that we should be doing an abdominal X-ray, mm-hmm. to make the diagnosis of small bowel obstruction. We're also encouraged to minimise radiation exposure for patients because, we should do radiation. It's not exactly beneficial to, mm-hmm. to health in general. So if you have an abdominal X-ray and you look at all the literature that's out there, the sensitivity and specificity of an abdominal X-ray for detection of small bowel obstruction is about 50-50. So you might as well flip a coin to decide whether this patient has small bowel obstruction. The benefit of flipping a coin is that the patient doesn't get a dose of radiation they don't need. This has been backed up if you look at the NCPOD report, delay in transit, and the NASPO report. Everyone says don't bother doing an abdominal X-ray. And the simple reason is that if you think someone's got a story that says they have small bowel obstruction and you do an abdominal X-ray, the abdominal X-ray says, yeah, it looks like they might have small bowel obstruction, you're going to do a CT. If it says, no, they don't have a small bowel obstruction, you're going to say, well, my spidey sense says actually they do, so I'm going to do a CT. So if all your possible decisions are you're going to do a CT, why not just do a CT? It doesn't make sense. Obviously, there's added benefits of doing a CT. Not only can it confirm the diagnosis with pretty high sensitivity and specificity, it can give you an indication of the location of the level of obstruction. It can give you an idea of the status of the bowel. And there's a few findings on the CT scan that are quite useful. So the wall enhancement of the bowel is quite a useful marker.
So this is a CT with contrast, yeah? Obviously.
Yeah, CT with contrast, yeah. If you do a CT without contrast, you're not going to get an idea about the vascular enhancement in the within the small bowel. And, you know, there's lots of chat about contrast-induced nephropathy. Actually, in this setting, it's potentially an intra-abdominal, well, it is an intra-abdominal emergency until proven otherwise. you've just got to, I think you just have to take the gamble and just go give them IV contrast and get on with it. Oral contrast, I don't think there are many places that will do long oral prep on a CT, and that's good because neither pathways encourage us to get that CT done sooner than we could if we were doing oral prep. So CT with IV contrast. As I said, it'll tell you about ischemia. If you've got thickened walls of the bowel in the area, or fecalization, or free fluid, ascites type fluid, then those are things that make you say, hang on a minute, not only does this person have obstruction, but they've got findings that mean they probably need an intervention sooner rather than later because their gut is under threat.
Okay, so fecalization might be a term that people aren't familiar with. What's that?
Sure. So if you've seen feces on a CT scan, they've got quite a distinctive appearance of sort of soft, slightly enhancing stuff with pockets of gas within them. And it just looks like it is a lump of food. That's what feces are. Yeah. Where you get the fecalization of the small bowel, that you're seeing a similar thing happen. So things have been sat there so long it's started to ferment and get bits of gas in them. And that can only happen if they're being held up at a point for, so long. Mm. Fecalization is just that sort of gassy appearance within the small bowel content.
So it gives you an idea that the obstruction's slightly gone on for a bit longer than ones that aren't fecalized. So it's sure. had a lot of its chance to get better by itself, I suppose, by
That's
then.
It.
Is that okay? So there we are. So that we're done a CT scan, and we're on to it's decision time now. We resuscitated the patient. We've got a catheter in. We've got an NG tube in. Both of those tubes are very important, like you said. And we've done a CT scan, we've got the results back, and now it's decision time. So take us down the what-ifs. Let's say, in the first instance, probably easier decision, that there are no scars or hernias, but they have small bowel obstruction.
Okay, sure. So this is a scenario that we'd call, it sounds like what we're talking about is a virgin abdomen, probably most likely with a congenital band adhesion, or sometimes an internal hernia. As a rule, it's certainly in UK practice, that person's going to get an operation because it's the kind of thing that's probably been there all their lives. It's just started causing the problem. It's usually a single band that needs sorting out. That's where we're going to go. And that can often be done laparoscopically if it's usually just the one band that needs to go. If you were in the States, there has been some discussion about giving people a trial of conservative management. Much akin to adhesive small bowel obstruction, one of the strategies is adhesive small bowel obstruction. But I don't think that we are there, particularly given that there's a large number of these actually do have internal hernias, and that's something that we have to deal with because it forms a closed loop obstruction, which needs relieving manually sooner rather than later.
Okay, and then the CT
virgin abdomen gets an operation.
Okay, so virgin abdomen get an operation, and you've done a CT scan, so we know if it's a cecal tumour or something else causing that as well. So you can plan what you do and get the right people in. Do it. Okay, so that virgin abdomen. You've got a. What's the next one? You've got a hernia, let's say a groin hernia of some kind, causing the obstruction.
Sure. So again, groin hernias aren't really going to get better without an operation. If you look at hernias as a global group, most hernias need an operation if they're causing obstruction, with the exception of incisional hernias, which actually behave more like adhesive small bowel obstruction. So what I say now probably applies to most of the hernia types. Typically, so if you talk about groin hernias, you're talking about an older person who's going to be frail, who's almost certainly been festering on a medical ward for a few days because they've been treated for gastroenteritis and not an obstruction. So this is someone where you have to absolutely get it right. So this person needs an operation, they need to be adequately resuscitated, and they should probably go to HDU post-op. Because they're physiologically not going to do well. And we know that from the NASBO data, about 15% of people who had a hernia died in hospital, compared to less than 10% of people with adhesive small bowel obstruction. Mm. So it's not just a hernia. You do need the right people in. An anaesthetist who appreciates how sick the person is, and then just to get on and fix them.
Mm. So they're elderly, they're comorbid, they've probably got some degree of cardiovascular impairment, they've been dehydrated, which puts extra strain on the heart, and then they have an anaesthetic. And if they're not properly resuscitated and filled up, then that puts the extra strain on. And death from perioperative cardiac event is 40% or so, isn't it? So, you know, high risk, high risk people, and important not to underestimate that. Okay, so that's hernias. And we're going to talk about incisional hernias in a separate podcast trailer. And what about those then that you think it's a decent obstruction? So they've got a scar, they haven't got any hernias. How are we going to manage those, and how are we going to prioritise who needs operation, who doesn't need an operation, and how long we're going to continue conservative management for?
So adhesive small bowel obstruction is it's not actually, I don't think it's actually that complicated, but it can be made, people might lead you down that route. So we've done our CT scan, we know they've got adhesive small bowel obstruction. If there are any features on that CT scan, wall thickening, ischemia, free fluid, fecalization, that person needs an operation. That's just the route we've got to go down. So don't wait around day one, get it done, get them sorted. Obviously, after adequate resuscitation with appropriate perioperative support and all those things, with a Nela risk score, HDU support, all of that. Then you've got the group who have, yes, this looks like adhesional small bowel obstruction on the CT, but there are currently no concerning features. So we're not going to operate on that group right now. I don't want to call it conservative management, because conservative management almost implies we're doing nothing, and actually you should be constantly reassessing this patient group. I would, so with that group who don't need an operation now, I'm going to make sure they've had good nasogastric drainage, and we've emptied as much of the backlog that's there. The next morning we'll see, so you can either see that if they've had a good 12 to 18 hours of drainage, getting towards the evening, you might want to do a gastrographin challenge, which is where we get one of the x-ray contrast bottles from radiology department, and depending where you work, your F1 may have to sell their soul to get hold of it, but that needs to come to the ward. The NG tube's spigoted, so only do it when you're happy you've got adequate drainage of the NG tube. Get the patient to drink it, leave the NG spigoted for a bit to allow it to pass, then you can go back onto drainage. And they need an X-ray. Patient needs an abdominal X-ray. This is the time you're allowed to do an abdominal X-ray. It's 6 hours post gastrographin administration. If you see contrast in the right colon, there's a high probability that you will get away without an operation.
It's
6 hours. 6 hours is a reasonable sensitivity specificity, somewhere around 98% sensitive, 98% specific, 96% sensitive. If you push it out to 12 hours, then, you know, your detection rate's a bit better. You've got slightly more people will have passed into the right colon. And the studies have gone as far as 24 hours, but I think that within the paradigm we're working in, the way that we want to do this, 24 hours is too long. You've got to make a decision before then. So the gastrographin challenge, or what soluble contrast agent, if we're being brand agnostic, is what we should be doing. And then either that person will pass contrast into the colon, and in which case you say, okay, we'll just continue our supportive care, see what happens. Or they won't pass contrast into the colon, in which case you say, well, you'll probably need an operation. So you need to operate on them by day three of the admission. And the reason we say that is because the longer you wait, the more likely something is to go wrong, particularly with respect to bowel strangulation. That person then goes from needing a straightforward adhesiolysis to having to have a laparotomy, small bowel resection, possibly a stoma bringing out, which might be high output. So they might be now in hospital for 3 months, 6 months while you get all that sorted out, compared to if you'd just bitten the bullet on day two and got on with it.
Stitching time saves nine.
That's absolutely it. And that delay beyond 72 hours, it's from or the Peacock's paper, which was published in the BJS, and I think that said that your odds of death within 90 days, if you operated on small bowel obstruction after 72 hours, your odds were 1.39. So they went up quite significantly. So that's the thing about timing. The other thing, just to comment on the timing, is that these are rough rules. You know, you either need an operation now, or we'll do some tests to see if you need an operation later. It's important to reassess patients, because actually some of them don't need an operation now, but will go off overnight. And so people need to take that seriously, not just leave it for the morning. One sort of the idea of failure to rescue in small bowel obstruction is largely based around missing ischemia, missing signs and symptoms of ischemia. And when you have to do a small bowel resection, that increases your risk of mortality. If you look at American data, by about 30%, which fits with, you know, our NELA data.
So that would be tachycardia, temperature, abdominal tenderness.
Absolutely. So we talk about suddenly worsening pain, and the patients will really tell you this is different. I can tell you it's now right in my right iliac fossa. It's definitely here. This is much worse. I want to lie still, whereas before I was, you know, I couldn't get comfortable. It was colicky. They may well get a fever, and if they've got a fever, that is someone where you really, you should be really thinking about intervening because you're worried about dead bowel. And as you said, tachycardic, hypotensive are the other things that go with that.
Okay.
So we manage them conservatively. We reassess them regularly. At 18 to 24 hours, we do a gastrographin, and then do another x-ray at 6 hours. If it goes through, we can safely leave them, but continue to monitor them. And if it doesn't go through, then they need to go to theatre.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to another podcast brought to you by School of Surgery. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook at School of Surgery, on iTunes, on Podomatic at schoolofsurgery.podomatic.com, and finally by searching School of Surgery on YouTube. Thank you very much, and see you next time.